Chapter 2. The lights were on in the loft. Gritting his teeth, Tony jammed his keys into his bag and stalked his way across the workshop. "Hey," he called, mounting the stairs with the rapid-fire clatter of his booted feet. "You know, this really counts as breaking and entering." "I have a key." Tiberius Stone set the book he was reading on the flat of his stomach, giving Tony a smile that was somewhere between pitying and pure sex. "You gave it to me." "Asked for it back, too, if I remember correctly." Tony gave Ty a look. He was in a graceful slump on Tony's bed, one arm behind his head and his feet bare on the covers. He'd unbuttoned the vest of his suit and hung his coat up from the hook beside the door, and his wingtips were resting on the heater. "Making yourself at home, aren't you?" Tony asked, telling himself that he wasn't horny. He'd made that mistake before, and he tried to learn from his bad decisions. "I would have thought that you would want me to be comfortable." Ty's smile dissolved into a pout, and he made no move to get up. Instead, he stretched, his back arching against the pillows. "Be a good host, Tony."
"Be less creepy, Ty."
Tony tossed his bag onto the already overflowing desk and dropped into the chair, ignoring the inviting way that Ty had left space next to him on the bed. "What do you want?" "Can't I just check in on my favorite ex?" Ty asked, letting out a faint sigh. He had a special and very annoying talent for making Tony feel bad about, well, everything.
"You can, but you don't, ever." Tony spun his chair around. "What do you want?"
Ty's sigh was audible even across the room. "I was in town, and..." "Yes, I notice that's been happening more and more often lately," Tony said. Already bored with this conversation, he went back to his work. That's what Ty wanted him to do anyway. That's why he was here. Ty made a pretense at other things, at interest in Tony and what he wanted out of life. But in the end, he was a company man through and through. And in his eyes, Stark Industries was a company Tony worked for, not the company that Tony would someday own.
"You've been out of touch," Ty said. "A lot of unanswered voicemails and emails, Tony."
"I've been busy." He had, too. Classes, paper revisions, arguing with his stubborn prick of an advisor, and Steve. Mostly Steve. He didn't like to say things aloud that would come back to humiliate him later, but he'd been seeing a lot of Steve. Nothing big, really. A lunch grabbed here, a phone call there, late-night messaging sessions when they both should have been asleep. He'd walked in the park. In all seriousness, he'd walked in Boston Common like he was a damn high schooler with a crush, and really that needed to stop. He was not going to act like a child about this. He needed to get laid, and despite some rather open invitations, he hadn't managed to get past second base with Steve, which was a source of eternal frustration.
"What do you want, Ty?"
Tony asked, trying to drag himself back to the problem at hand.
"Your father isn't answering his phone," Ty said, and Tony's stomach sank.
"You know what I'm going to say about that," Tony said, sparing Ty a glance. "In that we've had this discussion. We've had this discussion, like, a lot, haven't we?" "The health aide and Happy both report that he's alive, he's been eating, and..."
"Not my problem," Tony said, cutting him off with all the ruthlessness he could manage.
"It is not..." Ty rolled to his feet. "He's your father." Tony's shoulders hunched forward, his body curling up, his spine bowing as he tried to concentrate on the screen of his laptop. He gritted his teeth just a little.
"Look."
Ty leaned against the desk, propping his hip high on the wood, his arms folded over his chest and his expression disapproving.
"You're the only one who can snap him out of it when he gets like this, Tony. Obi has tried. It doesn't work."
Tony looked up, trying not to resent the angle and the way that Ty pushed ever so subtly into his personal space.
"Yeah, but I didn't sign up to deal with his abuse."
Ignoring Ty, he reached across the desk for a stylus.
"And there's no reason."
Ty caught his wrist, his big hand closing around Tony's arm with room to spare.
"He's your father." I'd say that was reason enough, wouldn't you? You would. I wouldn't. Tony gave a sharp tug, trying to pull his arm free, and Ty's fingers bit into his skin, the pressure bordering on the painful. Ty, seriously, who cares if he picks up the phone? It's not like he has anything worthwhile to say. You know he's not dead. He hasn't managed to drink himself into a coma. You've got people checking on his pulse every day. So why do you give a flying fuck if he picks up the phone or not? Ty leaned over, pushing closer to Tony, never once letting go of Tony's wrist. Because someone needs to do more than check his pulse. And I did it, Tony said, his chin up, his ire up. 4 years, I did it. OB did what he could do, but he didn't move in, Ty. I spent years after my mom's death checking his vitals and dealing with his crazy, with his drunken ravings and whatever poison he managed to come up with and spew at me from day to day. I'm done with it, and you know it. Tony braced himself, and with a sharp twist of his arm, pulled his wrist out of Ty's grip. The skin burned from the pressure and the touch itself, and Tony resisted the urge to rub it. Tell Obi to go over there. I'm not flying down to New York just because he's in a bad spell. As you've so cheerfully pointed out to me about 1,000 times, I have work that needs to be done, and things that need to be passed in. Shoving his chair back, Tony ducked past him, going for the door. You can show yourself out. I've got some welding to do. Tony. Tony kept moving forward, 1 foot in front of the other, keeping his pace slow and steady with an act of will, because he would not run. He would not flee like a scared child from whatever barrage that Ty had in store for him. He knew better than to show that kind of weakness. 1 foot, and then the other, quick and even. His foot was just breaking the threshold when Ty's voice came quietly behind him. He's your dad. Tony's hand latched onto the doorframe, his fingers tightening until they ached, until the skin over his knuckles was white with the strain. He held for a moment, his pride carrying him when his exhaustion would have dragged him down again, and then his head fell forward. What do you expect me to do? He asked, resigned to his fate, resigned to everything. Just go talk to him. Ty was magnanimous in his victory. He always was. He slipped a hand around Tony's waist, leaning into Tony's back, pressing close from chest to knees. His body was almost as familiar to Tony as his own, the subtle shift of muscle and bone, the heat of his skin, and the rhythm of his breath. It's going to be okay, Tony. Tony stared blankly into the darkness, his eyes unfocused. He took a breath, and he could smell Ty's cologne, his aftershave, his hair gel. Ty's fingers stroked low on the flat of Tony's belly, his head dipping down so his mouth could brush against Tony's neck, whisper light and delicate. Tony's head tipped to the side, his body reacting automatically, even though it felt wrong. He shook off the feeling with gritted teeth. It was just sex. He liked sex. Ty kissed his way up Tony's neck, and Tony stood there staring at nothing. His body reacted to the familiar stimulus, eager, as always, for the contact, for the warmth and the pleasure that Ty's touch promised. Ty was many things, but mostly he was very, very good in bed. Tony reached up, trailing his fingers along the length of Ty's arm, feeling the flex of his muscles. He closed his eyes and tried to feel something beyond the physical. Something deeper. Something. Anything. But that had always been what this was. A desperation for contact. A need that he couldn't verbalize when he was younger. Ty had been there. Ty had been smart and handsome and clever with his hands. And Obi approved of Ty. And for a long time, that had been all that mattered. That he could cling to Ty and blank his mind and just feel. Feel. Anything. He twisted free of Ty's grip, turning in Ty's arms and leaned in for a kiss. Ty was caught off guard, his body going stiff in an instant, but he melted quickly, his hand smoothing down the arch of Tony's spine. Tony leaned into his touch, into his heat, his mouth opening under the pressure of Ty's lips. He waited, only partially participating in the kiss, waiting to feel something, anything, some stirring of regret or anger or love or affection. But there was nothing, just lust. And lust, he understood lust, and he was pretty quick to forget it. When they broke apart, Tony's mouth felt bruised and his heart was pounding. He stared at Ty, his lips twitching upwards. "Well," he said, stepping back, "that answers that." Ty's brow creased and his mouth twisted into a frown. "What answers what?" "Never mind." Tony took a deep breath, and the buzz of pleasure was already passing, already seeping away, leaving that familiar, faint numbness. "Sorry, I've got work to do. And I bet you're on the red eye, so let's just skip the slap and tickle today, shall we?" Ty's face was a thundercloud. Tony wasn't foolish enough to think it had anything to do with him. Ty just hated to be rejected. "Bit of a tease, aren't you?" Tony grinned at him. "Always. Otherwise, how could I keep your attention?" Ty gave a huff of laughter, clearly against his will. "Yeah, whatever, you dick." He turned back to the bed, reaching for his shoes. "Obi'll get you a ticket." "Obi'll send me the damn jet if he wants me to do this," Tony said. "I'm doing him a favor. I'm not flying commercial." Laughing, Ty wandered back out of the bedroom. He ruffled Tony's hair as he pushed past, the gesture affectionate in an offhand sort of way. It was like Tony was a dog that belonged to a neighbor with whom he needed to stay on good terms. "I'll see what I can do. You want credit for getting me on board?" Tony said, his voice saccharine. "You'll do what needs doing." He headed down to the workshop. "You're good at that." Behind him, Ty was saying something. Was saying something scolding or sharp or chiding. But Tony wasn't listening anymore. He'd heard it all before and he didn't really care. His lips were tingling, and it had nothing to do with Ty and everything to do with the memory of Steve's gentle, almost uncertain kisses. Tony's fingers brushed against his mouth, and he grinned. "Are you even listening to me?" Ty snapped. "Not at all. Have a good flight, Ty." Whistling under his breath, Tony headed for the workbench. He had some nervous energy to work off, and he probably wasn't going to get laid after that comment. The door slammed shut with a metallic clang, proving that right. He found he didn't much care. Mostly because he just might have a boyfriend. The taxi dropped him off at the front of the massive, imposing gate, the huge wrought iron expanse that separated the Stark mansion on Fifth Avenue with the street. Tony paid the cabbie, ignoring the man's curious looks, and waited for the taxi to roll away before he moved to the intercom. He knew that his arrival had already been noted, but there were protocols to this. Obi had made sure of that. He pressed the intercom button. "Happy? It's Anthony. Want to let me in?" The faint buzz reached him, a stark affirmative, and then the gates started to open. They moved slowly, awkwardly, pushing back from the street, and Tony slipped in as soon as they parted enough for his slim form to make it through. Hands in his pockets, head down, he headed up the drive, trying to ignore the cold. The black car parked right in front of the door wasn't one that he knew, and he frowned at it. However, before he could reach it, the front door opened, and a trim, ordinary-looking man in a crisp black suit strode easily down the icy stone steps. He looked up, meeting Tony's eyes, with a faint, unassuming smile, and then he slipped into the passenger seat of the car. It started up almost before the door was closed, and by the time Tony reached the top of the drive, the car was already rolling down, sweeping past him with a nearly soundless sweep of the tires on frozen stone. Tony stared after it, making note of the license plate, an ordinary-looking New York one, and of the unfamiliar circular logo that was on it. He turned off the main drive, heading for the guard shack. Happy Hogan was waiting for him at the door. "Hey, Mr. Stark," he said, grinning at Tony. The guard/chauffeur was a fixture around the house. Nominally, he was on the Stark payroll, but Tony knew he reported to Obi. "Hey, Happy," Tony said, even as Happy waved him into the guardhouse. He stepped inside, grateful for the warmth. "Who was that?" Happy shrugged. "I got no clue," he admitted. "Fella showed up, said to tell your father that he wanted an audience, and insisted Mr. Stark would want to speak to him. Called up to the main house, and I don't claim to understand it, but Mr. Stark told me to let him right in." Tony frowned. "Did he give you his name?" he asked. "Nope. Just said he had information that Mr. Stark would want about the location of the last of the Howling Commandos." Happy frowned. "I don't know what that means, but Mr. Stark just about swallowed his tongue. Insisted I let the guy in." Tony glanced at the security monitors where the man's pleasant face was locked in a freeze frame. "Can you print that off for me?" he asked. "And Happy, can you give me a few minutes to talk to my father before you call Obi?" Happy's face fell. "Ah, Mr. Stark, you know I'm supposed to tell him if there's anything." "I'm not saying don't tell him," Tony said, cutting him off. "I'm just saying give me a few minutes before you tell him. Because you know Obi will flip out about this. And maybe I can get some more information so that we can keep him from making both of our lives pure hell." Happy's eyes met his, then flicked away. Tony held his breath, but after an instant, Happy gave a quick nod. "I can, you know, not call him right now," he said, even as he handed Tony the printout. Tony took it with a sigh of relief. "But I gotta call it in. You know, I know. Tony folded the sheet a couple of times and jammed it in his pocket. "You won't regret this." "Every time you say that, I end up regretting it," Happy called after him. But they both knew that he hated the responsibility. He didn't want it, and he didn't need it, and he was happier when Tony took over and handled things the same way everyone else was. Tony didn't even like to think about how long he'd been handling things. He paused at the front door, his hand still on the cold metal of the knob for a long, long second. The key turned smoothly in the lock, and he pushed it open, ignoring the way the cold night air rushed in, pushing him into the dark space beyond the doorframe. "Dad?" Tony dropped his bag just inside the door, where he could find it easily enough when he needed to, like when he left, probably tonight. If it was too late to make a run back to Boston, the city had enough hotels, and he had a credit card. "Dad?" Stripping off his boots and coat, Tony left them where they fell. Other than his detritus, the front hall was spotless as always. Fresh-cut flowers filled all the vases. The floor was waxed to a mirror shine, and the windows glittered in the reflected light of the street lamps. It was as if no one lived here, and Tony guessed that was close enough to the truth. The Fifth Avenue mansion was occupied only by ghosts at this point. Tony was glad he'd left before he became one. He paused at the bottom of the stairs. "Dad?" From someplace up above, there was a thump, something solid hitting the carpeted floor. With a minute shake of his head, Tony jogged up the stairs. "Dad, Obi said you weren't answering the phone. Not even for him?" He reached the top landing. And he was still talking because startling Howard was a lousy idea. "Dad, it's Tony. Are you still alive?" The only sliver of light on the landing came from the library, and Tony headed in that direction. "Dad," he called, pushing the door open, just a bit, just a crack, waiting. It only took a minute, and then there was a wet crash as a bottle hit the other side of the door, crashing to splinters. Tony waited, seeing if Howard was double-fisting tonight, but there was silence, other than a racking, echoing cough, and Tony shoved the door open. Howard looked up. "Welcome home," he said, his face twisting in a macabre approximation of a smile. "Where the hell have you been?" "Boston." Tony stared at his father, wishing it didn't always hurt. Howard was a mess. They both knew it, even if the rest of the world lived on in ignorance. Tony wasn't sure why, hadn't been sure when it had started, or how it had progressed this far, this fast, but Howard was a mess. He was slumped behind his massive desk now, a gargoyle in the shadows of a single-tipped desk lamp. His face was unshaven, his shirt half-buttoned and filthy, his hair a rat's nest of tangles. His eyes were unfocused and full of something dark and vicious. But he raised his head when Tony picked his way through the wreckage of the office. This room had been a showpiece once. Now it was a cave, where Howard retreated to lick his wounds and nurse the bottle. As Tony moved across the room, Howard dumped a healthy amount of brandy into the cracked crystal tumbler in front of him. "What are you doing here, boy?" he asked, his voice raw and rough. Either from abuse or disuse, Tony wasn't sure. "Checking up on you." "Fuck you. I don't need you poking your nose into my business," Howard said, his lips peeling back from his teeth. He tossed back most of the glass of alcohol in one quick gulp, and his arm had a visible tremor when he brought it back down. "Saw your latest plans. They're crap." "Yeah, well, you can't even figure out which end of a welding torch to pick up right now, so..." Tony ignored the sting of the words. "By now, they fell on scar tissue, thick with memories of past abuse, and what had once been a raw wound now was just a twitch of pain." Howard couldn't help what he was now, and Tony couldn't help him. He reached for his father's arm. "Let's go. I think you need to get some sleep. Somewhere that isn't here." Howard stirred, his head lolling on his neck, as if he had no control over his movements. "They won't stop hounding me," he snarled. But there was a melancholy note to his voice, something not unlike a sob. "They keep bringing it all back. All of it. They're all dead. Why can't they just let it die?"
Howard's breath came in raw pants.
"Why do they ask me questions I can't answer?"
"Yeah, that's something that happens," he said, tired of this already. "Come on, Dad, you've had enough for tonight." He grabbed Howard's arm and pulled him to his feet, getting absolutely no help from his father. Halfway to getting upright, Howard started struggling and Tony lost his grip, dumping him back into his seat.
"Jesus, Dad!"
"You little pissant," Howard said, swinging an arm in Tony's direction. Tony stepped back, easily avoiding it, and a decanter hit the carpet instead, the dregs of the alcohol spilling out. Tony stepped around the sodden puddle, ignoring the sharp scent of whiskey.
Get!
Howard swung again, and this time, Tony just caught his wrist and forced it down.
"Cut it out," Tony said, out of patience already.
He didn't have much to begin with, and his father was good at running it down. He snagged the front of Howard's shirt and muscled him up.
"God, you are a pain in the goddamn ass!"
Howard's hand fumbled at the desk, knocking things over and grabbing for anything in reach. He tossed a folder at Tony's head, and Tony shoved him towards the door.
"Great! Fantastic!"
Howard's legs went limp, and Tony just pulled him along, ignoring what might have been passive resistance and might have been just an inability to make his legs work properly.
"Time for bed, you old lush."
"Have some respect," Howard spat out. His head was hanging down, his words slurring, but his hands were clinging to Tony, clawing at his shirt, at his arms.
I don't need you to..."
Tony heard the ominous rattling sound and shoved Howard in the direction of the nearest trash can. "You know," he said, staring blankly at the wall as Howard vomited into the trash can, "I had other plans for this weekend. Plans that didn't include your drunk ass." He glanced down.
"You done?"
"I think you're done." Ignoring the mess and the stench for now, he headed for the door, Howard little more than an anchor that slowed him down with every step. Howard's room was dark, unkept, and oppressive, the gloom almost a physical weight on the skin. Tony tried not to breathe in, hating the stale smell of alcohol, unwashed clothing, and his future. He shoved Howard into bed, too tired to bother with trying to get him cleaned up. He stripped Howard's shirt and pants, ignoring the abuse Howard poured over him. Tossing the blanket over him, Tony stepped back.
"You going to live till the morning?" he asked. Howard pried one bloodshot eye open, his lips peeling back from his teeth.
You just can't wait for me to die, can you, boy?
Tony stared at him for a second, words bubbling low in his throat, something hot and acidic caught behind his teeth. But when he opened his mouth, all that came out was a sigh.
You've been dead for years, he said, his voice quiet. I've been you for years. He headed for the door. So go fuck yourself.
Back in the library, he looked at the mess with a jaded eye.
Great, Dad, he mumbled. Fan-fucking-tastic.
He picked his way across the floor, avoiding the worst of the mess. But there were discarded bottles, empty glasses, dirty dishware, and the remains of books and paperwork everywhere.
Jesus Christ.
Too exhausted to even think about it, he grabbed a folder and started shoving things back into it. Crumbled plans and blueprints, chunks of paper and photos, classified stuff that the cleaning staff shouldn't have access to. But judging by the smell of the room, the cleaning staff hadn't made much of an effort to get in. He tossed folder after folder onto the desk, frustration rising as he jammed everything back together. Leaning over, he picked up the folder that Howard had thrown at him, shoving yellowed pages and faded pictures back into it. He pitched it onto the desk a second before his brain kicked in.
What the fuck?
He opened it back up, pushing the pages aside. His fingers closed on the photo and he turned on the desk lamp, twisting it around. The face staring up from the picture was startlingly familiar. Tony sank into the desk chair, frowning down at the picture. Howard was there. Tony spotted him immediately. A very young and cocky Howard, his chin up and his grin bright. And just behind him was a man who looked something almost like a pale, washed-out photocopy of Steve. But it wasn't Steve. It couldn't be. It couldn't. This man was much smaller than Steve, thin and almost frail, definitely undersized. His narrow shoulders were held back, sharp and tight in the World War II-era military uniform that seemed to dwarf him and his slight frame. But that face, thinner. His eyes narrowed against the light, his chin held up at a sharp angle. He stared at the camera lens with a sort of defiance, like he wasn't sure what was coming, but he was preparing for it anyway. Tony flipped it over, checking the back. Project Rebirth was neatly printed along with a date and a string of numbers that didn't mean anything to him. A string of names, or the start of names. Several of them were blacked out with a heavy application of ink. Howard's was still there, at the head of the column, and a handful of others, but no indication of what face went with what name, or who had been blotted out. He turned it back over. The resemblance was eerie. There had to be a blood relation. There had to be. It would explain why Tony kept feeling as if he'd seen Steve before. Not that they'd met, but rather that his face was familiar. He'd written it off to having passed Steve in the street, or on the train, or in some library, moving left when Steve was moving right, another face in the crowd. But this, maybe this was why Steve seemed familiar and yet so alien, because Tony was remembering someone else's face. Not that he'd ever seen this picture before. He grabbed the folder, flipped it open, dumped the documents and the pages across the desk. He sorted through them as quick as he could, but most of them were a sea of black ink, censored, redacted. On top, a bundle of letters, a dozen or more. He pulled one off the top, the neat slit of the envelope and the paperclip holding letter and envelope together were clear signs that his father's secretary had handled these, and unsure what to do with the contents, had sent them over to the house to molder and rot along with their owner. The one on top was only a few weeks old, and Tony flipped open the page without a trace of guilt. After the initial greeting, the letter was brief and to the point. The writer was a graduate student at Harvard, looking to speak to Howard about his thesis, which wasn't that unusual. Tony knew that Stark Industries got dozens, if not hundreds, of these every year. They were politely rejected, with an indication to contact the company when their studies were over. Perhaps a place could be found for them. Engineers and scientists and designers, all of them chased the ghost of Howard Stark, even if they had no idea that he was already gone. But this one was from a historian. Tony frowned at it, reading the text with no comprehension. There was a long string of qualifications and an attempt at an introduction from a mutual acquaintance, then the purpose of the letter in a few quick, straightforward lines. I've been researching the so-called American Captain, the battlefield legend of World War II. What I've managed to find in government archives leads me to think you might have some insights into the identity of this particular individual or the multiple individuals who carried the shield. I would like to speak to you at your earliest convenience. The letter was signed by Lieutenant James Rhodes, United States Air Force. A quick glance through the rest of the letters revealed a similar vein to the questions, but most were years or decades old. Tony frowned down at James Rhodes' letter and the postmark. Without thinking twice, he jammed the envelope in his pocket. Grabbing the picture, he headed back to Howard's room. Howard was tossing beneath the sheets, his breathing rough and uneven, and Tony grabbed his shoulder, gave him a quick shake, and another, just enough to get Howard's blurry eyes open. When Howard struggled to focus on him, Tony held up the photo. "Who is this?" he asked. Putting a finger just below the fragile man's chin, he tapped the picture, drawing Howard's eye. "This man. What's his name?" Howard's lips curled up just a little, and for an instant he looked the way he had when Tony had been a child. "Him?" His eyes slid shut. He pulled free of Tony's hands. "Just a kid from Brooklyn." He rolled over, and in another second he was snoring. Tony stared down at him for a long moment, his heart still in his chest. With a bitten back curse, he walked back out of the room, pulling the door shut behind him. Halfway to the library, he pulled his phone out, dialing Obi with a flick of his thumb. "Stop letting him get booze delivered," he said, interrupting Obi's greeting. There was a long beat of silence, then a sigh. "How well has that worked out for us in the past?" Obi asked, sounding tired. Tony slammed into the library. "Yeah, well, you know what? He needs to be in rehab. In a fucking facility that can make an attempt at drying him out without him ending up dying when the withdrawal hits him sideways. But he's going to die, Obi." The silence was thick with disapproval. "How do you see that going?" Obi asked. "We've been telling the public. We've been telling the board of directors, the shareholders, the buyers. We've been telling everyone he's fine. If we put him in a facility, Tony, there's no way that won't end up going public. Maybe we will lose the company," Obi said, cutting him off. "You'll lose the company. You understand that, don't you, Tony? All of it gone." Tony stared down at the folder and wondered if Obi would hang up on him if he just said that was what he wanted. That he didn't care anymore, that he'd been doing this for years, been lying and hiding and living behind the thin bars of a cage, and now he was almost free. He just had to finish his degree, and he would be free. He wouldn't have to lie, wouldn't have to keep making things in Howard's name. He wouldn't have to do anything he didn't want to do. Hell, he didn't even have to be a Stark anymore. "All those people," Obi said. "Do you know how many people depend on Stark Industries, Tony? How many paychecks? How many mortgages and college tuition bills? How many people who have children to feed?" He sighed. I have a responsibility to them. I chose this company. I chose your father as a friend, as a partner. You," his voice trailed away. Tony's hands were in white-knuckled fists on the surface of the desk. He struggled to breathe, struggled to hold himself together. After a moment, he let his eyes fall shut. "He's drunk and agitated," Tony said, picking up the folder. He flicked through the pages, trying not to damage the yellowed, fragile paper. "Did he tell you why?" Tony opened his mouth.
ready to explain the mysterious visitor, the file, the strange set of coincidences, but something stopped him. He stared down at the pages and wondered if Obi knew anything about this, if Obi could tell him what it was, or if this was a secret that Howard had kept. He wondered if any of this was in the SI databases.
No, Tony said aloud. There were too many coincidences here, too many things he didn't understand. He needed info, and he didn't know where to get it. He snapped the folder shut. He didn't. But he's asleep now. Just get someone over here to clean the place up, will you?
I'll send someone to keep an eye on him for a while, Obi agreed, back to being placating now that he was getting his way and he knew it.
Just be patient, Tony. In a few years, when you're old enough to be,
I know, Tony said, cutting him off before the full weight of Obi's words could bring him to his knees.
Look, I have work to finish, for SI and for school. I'm heading back tonight.
The silence that followed was thick with disapproval. Tony ignored it, ignored the guilt and the frustration and the sense of having failed, because that was normal by now. He held out, his jaw clenched against the urge to take it back, to agree to stay there, under Howard's thumb.
If you're sure, Obi said at last.
I am. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Without waiting for Obi to say goodbye, Tony cut the call. Taking a deep breath, he considered the folder that was clutched in one hand. Making a snap decision, he called the guardhouse.
Hey, Happy?
Yeah, I just called Obi. I told him what happened. We're on it.
Great, Happy said, relief thick in his voice, because God knows both of them hated giving Obi bad news. His temper was not a lot of fun to deal with, and when Tony was being honest with himself, he'd admit that he was scared of his nominal guardian, the man who'd stood between the Stark family and complete ruin for years. Tony might have kept the company running, but it was Obi who made it possible, and they both knew it.
Thanks, Tony.
Yeah, no problem. I'm heading back to Boston. Can you call me a cab?
You got it, boss.
Tony took a deep breath. And the folder. He needed answers. And maybe one Lieutenant James Rhodes was a place for him to start.
How are we doing today, Captain?
Steve stared, blank-faced and resigned at the far wall of the small clinic.
Fine, sir.
Dr. Donald Blake didn't even look from the file in his hands as he lowered himself onto his chair. He set his cane next to him, well within reach, but out of the way.
Now why don't I believe that? He asked, a faint smile creasing his cheeks.
Steve shrugged.
I'm sorry, sir.
For a long moment, Dr. Blake just looked at him, his sharp gaze measuring. He looked tired, thin, and far more fragile than his relatively young age would suggest. But he was fragile, his movements careful, and the way he held himself, cautious. His hands were steady and strong, though, and he flipped through Steve's file.
How have you been sleeping?
Steve steeled himself from flinching.
Fine.
Dr. Blake took a deep breath and let it out in a sigh. He clicked his pen with a flick of his thumb and made a notation on the file.
Are you eating well?
3 meals a day, sir.
And more. He was always hungry.
Not in the way he had been as a kid when he'd been aware that the sustained, empty ache of hunger would be his constant companion, but in a way that was still unfamiliar. His metabolism was a blessing and a curse, and the more he exercised, the more he ate. It was embarrassing how much he ate.
Any issues you'd like to report?
Dr. Blake was bent over his file, his pale hair gleaming in the light. A pair of reading glasses were tucked into the breast pocket of his crisp white lab coat, but he almost never put them on. He would hunch over Steve's reports out of habit, or because he preferred it that way. Steve was never quite sure.
No, sir.
Dr. Blake's head came up and his eyes were worried. He set the file to the side and reached for Steve's arm. The nurse had already taken his pulse, his blood pressure, checked his reflexes and his vision and his hearing. He'd been weighed and measured.
his cheek swabbed and blood sample after blood sample taken. Steve was used to it, the constant and changing round of medical tests, running on a treadmill, monitors beeping in time with his steps, or sensors stuck to his temples and his chest, measuring temperature and brain activity and pulse and blood pressure all at once. But every time, Dr. Blake would take his arm with firm, gentle hands and tip it into the light to check that the pinprick holes in the hollow of his elbow had disappeared, healing in a matter of minutes. He would smooth a finger over Steve's skin, his face puzzled, as if he couldn't quite believe the proof in front of him. Then he'd pull out the blood pressure cuff, and Steve would close his eyes and try to relax. "Corporal Rushman says you've got a full class schedule this term," Dr. Blake said, his fingers flexing on the ball of the blood pressure cuff. Steve blinked, caught off guard by the change in routine. "Yes," he said, "I do." Dr. Blake nodded, his head down over his gauges. "You look better," he said, and his voice was very, very quiet. His eyes came up, meeting Steve's, just for a second, and then they were flickering away. "I'm glad." He ripped the cuff off of Steve's arm with a harsh rattle of Velcro giving way. Steve steeled himself from flinching. He pushed his stool back, grabbing a folder from the small desk. "Here's your weekly medical questionnaire. You're used to the drill by now." Steve took the folder from him. "Yes, sir." Dr. Blake let out a faint sigh. "If you ever want to talk, Captain, I'm happy to speak to you." He reached for his cane, using it to lever himself back into a standing position. When he was stable, he folded his hands on top of the handle, his long fingers folding together. "Whether you believe it or not, I am concerned for you." "I know," Steve managed, a tight-lipped smile. "Thank you, sir." He stood, his shoulders tight, his skin crawling. He hated being here. He hated this place, the blank faces and the measuring eyes and the way he felt like a bug pinned to a card to be studied. He'd fought against it at first, for a long time, days, weeks, months. He'd fought and struggled and become little more than a wild animal. He'd spent hours repeating his name, his rank, his ID number, over and over and over. He'd stared into the darkness, strapped to a metal chair, as shadowy figures discussed him as if he wasn't there or wouldn't understand. He had fought until he realized that there was no way to fight this, until he realized just how alone he was. His name, his birth certificate, his social security number, his history and his background, his family history and his military history, everything had been granted to him and could just as easily be pulled away. How could he fight without a weapon, without any hope of gaining one? His fingers were locked tight on the folder of paperwork, and he made an effort to relax his fingers, to smooth out his breathing. Another session was almost done, another set of paperwork, another vial of blood sent somewhere he didn't want to think about. Dr. Blake opened the door to the examination room, and Corporal Rushman was waiting, her beautiful face serene beneath her neat sweep of red hair. "Ready, Captain?" she asked, her voice polite. She held out a hand, her slim fingers reaching for his file, and he handed it over. He wondered sometimes if they didn't trust Blake either. "This way," she said, tucking the folder under her arm. "Lieutenant Wilson is waiting for you." "Yes, ma'am." He fell into step behind her, knowing the way, and also knowing better than to try to suggest that he'd make his way there alone. As long as he was on military property, and he had no illusions, this small combination laboratory and clinic in the heart of Boston was most certainly military property. His movements were controlled. Their way of reminding him that his relative freedom outside these walls was an illusion, and they could revoke it at any time. Steve didn't have any delusions about his situation. Not anymore. Corporal Rushman led the way to the elevator where Clint was sprawled in a chair, checking his arrows. He didn't even look up when they approached, his fingers sliding slowly and carefully along the length of an arrow shaft, but he did smile. "When are you going to go out with me?" he asked. "I'll pencil you in for somewhere between when hell freezes over and when pigs fly," Rushman said, unruffled. Clint laughed, his teeth flashing. "Care to translate that to the contemporary calendar?" Clint asked, still chuckling. "And maybe a particular restaurant?" "Signs point to no," she said, and the elevator door slid open. She stepped in without a backwards glance, and Steve stepped in after her. He glanced at her out of the corner of his eyes. "If you tell him to stop," he said cautiously, "he will. You shouldn't have to put up with him on the job." Rushman's head tipped in his direction, and he got the impression that she was surprised by something. "I know that," she said, and her painted lips formed the merest hint of a smile. "So why don't you?" Steve asked. She turned her gaze back to the elevator doors. "Because I don't want him to stop," she said, as if that was obvious. "If I did, Captain, I would see to it that he did. As it is, I find him amusing." The doors opened, and she stepped through them, walking briskly down the corridor with Steve a step behind. "Feel free to continue bringing him along." Against his will, his mouth twitched. "I don't have a choice, ma'am. He's the one who's allowed to drive." "We're in Boston, Captain. Only a madman would choose to get behind the wheel of a car here." She opened the door. "Which is why we task Specialist Barton with driving you around." "Keeps him off the street." Sam Wilson glanced up, his grin easy and bright. "I'm all for that. Thank you, Corporal." "Lieutenant." With a slight dip of her chin, Rushman retreated, closing the door behind her. Sam stood up, his hands braced on his desk, his grin easing into a warm smile. "Glad to see you again, Captain." He waved a hand towards the chairs on the other side of his desk. "Please have a seat." Steve took a deep breath, and another, and sank into the chair. He wondered how long he would continue to lie, to himself and to them. At some point, the truth would come out, and he didn't know what he'd do when that happened. Tony was pretty sure he shouldn't be looking at any of this. It didn't stop him, of course, but there were a lot of classified stamps on these pages, a lot of notations that he didn't understand, didn't even begin to understand. Diagrams and schematics and scribbled pages hastily ripped from a bound diary, all of them jumbled together. Tony was willing to blame the hasty way the folder had made its way across the room, but he got the feeling that most of this stuff had been in just as bad of shape before Howard had thrown it at him. It was such a mix of material that he was left stymied as to how it all fit together. On one hand, there was a complicated series of mechanical diagrams on whisper-thin tracing paper, the folds so delicate they threatened to break when he tried to flatten the sheets. On another, there was one page, an odd little drawing of a monkey in an old-fashioned army helmet holding a stack of guns that wasn't like anything else in there. Most of it clearly came from Howard's personal files and notebooks. Tony could see Howard's clean, almost architectural hand in the rest of the drawings, machines and metals, components and concepts, but this one wasn't his. He didn't have this sort of sense of humor. After a day of digging through the pages, of reading and rereading the files, he gave in, digging out the letter from Lieutenant Rhodes. It was showing his hand, and he knew it, but he was at a dead end. Maybe Rhodes, or whoever the hell he was, could throw him a rope. He waited until a time when the average American would consider a phone call socially acceptable, then put in the call. It rang twice before being picked up. The man on the other end of the phone answered with a crisp, no-nonsense, "Hello?" "Hello," Tony said, his voice smooth and professional despite the fact that he was lying around in his boxers and a sweatshirt that had definitely seen better days. "I'm looking to speak to Lieutenant James Rhodes, please." "This is he." Rhodes' voice was warm and firm, steady. What can I do for you?
Tony took a deep breath. My name is Tony Edwards, he said, leaning back in his chair. I handle Howard Stark's personal and professional correspondence.
There was a beat of silence.
I see. How can I help you, Mr. Edwards?
I'm in possession of your letter and I have some questions for you.
Tony tapped the eraser end of his pencil against his pad. For some reason, for this project, he'd shied away from doing anything on his tablet or computer. He'd searched both Howard's personal databases, as well as everyone attached to SI. There was no mention of any of this in any of them. He'd learned to follow his father's lead on some things.
I'm not sure what I can do for you, Lieutenant Rhodes said, the words cautious.
Neither am I, but I'd like to talk to you anyway.
Tony flipped through the pages, letting the file fall open to the picture.
You aren't the first to inquire to Mr. Stark about the individual mentioned. He hasn't chosen to speak to anyone about it up until this point, but he's getting old. He's considering your request.
Is that so?
It wasn't a question. Tony answered it anyway.
Yes.
Tony flipped the picture over again, considered the names.
I'd like to meet with you, go over the situation, and determine just what it is that you hope to gain by interviewing Mr. Stark.
And what do you hope to gain from talking to me, Mr. Edwards?
Peace of mind for my employer.
I'm not certain that...
Tony stared down at the picture and took a chance.
Does Operation Rebirth mean anything to you, Lieutenant Rhodes?
There was a long, heavy silence on the other end of the phone.
It does, Rhodes said very quietly.
And not many people know about that.
And what part it plays here, what do you...
Not on the phone.
Tony slapped the photo down.
I'm in Boston at the moment. Your letter says that you're studying at Harvard. Meet me.
I'm sorry, but I have no idea who you are. Why should I trust a word you say?
Tony grinned.
Because I know more about Operation Rebirth than you. And I think that information is something you're willing to risk a lot to get, and I'm willing to share.
He stood up, grabbing for his coffee cup. It was mostly empty, and what was left was of questionable quality, but that had never even slowed him down.
But I understand. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to call Stark Industries. Use the main listed number. I trust you know how to Google, being a Harvard man. Give them a call and tell the receptionist your name. She'll put you through to someone who will schedule your appointment with me.
He threw back the dregs of his coffee, ignoring the taste.
Fair enough?
Fair enough, Rhodes agreed.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Save it. We'll see if we can't be of help to one another.
Tony disconnected the line, leaning back in his chair, tipping it onto two legs. The face, so similar to Steve, stared up at him, stern and mute. The more Tony told himself that he was crazy, the more he couldn't shake the impression that something was seriously wrong. He reached for the bottle of scotch that was sitting beside his laptop. It was almost empty, and he tossed back the last dregs in one long swallow before he discarded it. He turned the picture over and reached for his computer. Most of the names were unreadable, but he might be able to pry them out from beneath the black ink that had been used to obscure them. The original writing had been done in pen, and that would leave pressure marks. He typed out the handful of names that hadn't been censored, saving them in a file for later investigation, and tossed the picture aside. He was halfway through the file again when his phone rang. He snagged it without looking up from the yellowed pages.
Hey, you have something for me?
Grendel's Pub, Harvard Square, tomorrow, 8 p.m., Mrs. Arbogast said, her voice crisp. He'll bring what you're looking for.
Tony made kissy noises into the retriever.
This is why you're my favorite, he said.
You're a rotten little brat, Mrs. Arbogast said, her smile audible in her voice.
Stay out of trouble, Mr. Edwards.
She stressed the final word, making Tony laugh.
I'll do my best, he said.
But my best isn't particularly good.
Oh, that is such a lie, she said.
And she would know. She'd known Tony since he was literally too young to talk. She was one of the few of Howard's hires that still worked for SI,
and one of the few he was certain he could still trust.
"Thanks," he said.
"Of course, Mr. Edwards,"
he could hear her smile.
"Stop in the next time you're in town, will you?"
"If I can get a visitor's badge," Tony told her.
It should have been a joke, but it really wasn't. He had no clearance. He had no access to his own company.
"We're allowed to bring family to lunch in the cafeteria. Just let me know when you're free."
"Thanks, Bambi."
"That's Mrs. Arbogast to you, you smart-mouthed little brat," she said, affectionate.
"Good luck, and be careful, all right?"
"I will, I will."
He made a kissing noise into the phone until she hung up on him, but he could hear her laughing at him. Tony grabbed his jacket. He had work to do. He always had work to do, but for now, he had errands to run before he could make his latest appointment. He went to shut the folder, and just before he could pull his hand away, a thought bolted through him. Tony stopped, flipped the folder open again, and picked up the photo, tilting it up into the light. "If Steve's parents are dead," he said slowly, "if he's got no family left, who was he so afraid of that night on the tee?" The thin face stared back at him, offering no answers. The cry of a red-tailed hawk brought Steve's head up. He stared up at the roof of the building where Clint was seated, in full view of the street, his legs dangling over the edge of the brick facade. He met Steve's eyes, and even from this distance, Steve could read the expression on his face. Clint reached up, pressing his fingers flat across his left breast, and then he rolled off the low stone wall and retreated back into the shadows. Steve didn't allow his footsteps to falter. On the off chance that he or both of them were being observed, he just kept moving forward, down the sidewalk, up the stone stairs, and through the front door. He was halfway up the stairs to his apartment when the meaning of Clint's gesture clicked in his brain. Fingers positioned like rows of medals and ribbons on the lapel of an officer. He opened his front door and wasn't surprised to find it unlocked. He slipped in and paused on the mat, removing his boots, cold with icy slush, and then his gloves, hat, muffler, one after another, slow, controlled, refusing to rush or change his pattern of behavior. When everything was hung up, neat and tidy to dry, he headed for the living room. General Ross was on his couch, one polished shoe propped on Steve's coffee table, sipping from a cup clearly taken from Steve's kitchen. Steve got the impression that neither gesture came naturally to him. It wasn't about wanting to put his feet up. It wasn't about having a hot cup of coffee on a cold winter's day. It was about making sure Steve understood that nothing here was really his, that Ross or anyone else had the right to walk in and do what they wanted, whenever they wanted. It was about making sure that Steve never felt comfortable anywhere, that he never had any sense of ownership, not only of his things, but of his own life. He was never to forget that whatever he had, it was because it had been extended to him, and what had been gifted could be easily taken back. He paused, still and silent, in the door, falling into parade rest without much thought. Ross, his gaze focused on the basketball game on TV, held up a finger, a quick gesture of 1 minute, and Steve waited. Waited, his eyes staring at nothing, struggling not to tense up. The play continued for several minutes, and then when the screen faded to a commercial, Ross reached for the remote, muting the sound. "Hello, Captain," he said, smiling in Steve's direction. He had the jovial voice and face of a grandfather, but his eyes were dark and flat, sharp beneath bushy white brows. He took a sip of his coffee and released a sigh. "How are your classes?"
"I'm enjoying them, sir," Steve said.
"I'm glad to hear that." Ross waved a hand at the chairs in Steve's living room. "Please, Captain, please have a seat. Rest. I know you've been working hard, and it can't be easy." Steve considered the minor act of rebellion of staying standing, but it didn't seem to be worth it. He was too tired for these games. Once, what seemed like a lifetime ago, pure stubbornness would have kept him up, would have demanded that the principle of the matter was enough for him to fight.
to fight until he was bloody and battered and aching. Now, however, he took the seat, saving what fight he had left in him for the things that mattered. Ross sipped his coffee, his eyebrows arched. "So you're adjusting very well to modern life, Captain. We're all very pleased."
"Thank you, sir."
"There were detractors to this idea. You understand that, don't you? There were those who felt that a weapon shouldn't be deployed unless it was in the field, in an actual battle. But I always felt this was better for you, for you to come to terms with what your life entailed now." Ross paused, sipped his coffee. He paused and let out a sigh. "It was better for you and us."
"Yes, sir," Steve said, the words robotic.
"And you've done an exceptional job fitting in, really. Lieutenant Wilson really was concerned that the experience would be too overwhelming, that the strain might be too much. But you've picked up on everything with remarkable speed." His smile was warm. "You're very adaptable. That will certainly come in handy later."
Steve was bored now. Bored with the veiled threats and the reminders that even though he felt like he was living his life, that he was making a life for himself, that was never going to be the case. He could run, of course. Clint might even let him go. But where would he go? What would he do? Everything he had, the unit had supplied. Every ID, every mark of identification. If he did run, he knew it would be a matter of hours before there was an APB out for him or a shoot-to-kill order. He gave Ross a faint smile.
"I do my best, sir."
"That's a good man." Ross stood up. "We've made some changes to your schedule. Focus on your studies. We want you to double up on your social work sessions with Lieutenant Wilson. He'll be in a better position to track your progress that way. You're going to quit your job this week."
Steve considered objecting. He liked the interactions with other artists, and even though his stipend from the Army was more than enough for his needs, he still liked the discount on his supplies. But if he quit, then he'd have more time. And all of a sudden, he found something to fill that time.
"Yes, sir," he said.
"Wonderful." Ross set his coffee cup down on the table. He glanced at his watch. "Thanks for your hospitality, son. My car will be here in a few minutes." He walked past, clapping a hand lightly on Steve's shoulder. "You do your country proud, Captain."
Steve stood. "Thank you, sir."
But Ross was already gone, and when he shut the door behind him, it was with a finality that sent a shiver down Steve's back. He waited at parade rest until he was sure that he was alone. Then he collected the coffee cup and brought it to the kitchen. He rinsed it, running water over the plain white surface, turning it slowly between his hands. He had no life here. He knew that was the truth. He would be pulled out soon enough when they figured out what to do with him, what purpose he served, how he could be used. He had no life. He just had a temporary leave from active military service. He was a fool for thinking he could have any more than that. Steve turned the water off and considered the cup. Walking over to the trash, he dropped it in and heard it crack on the bottom of the empty can. He was a fool, he was an idiot, but he'd spent too long waiting. Too much time had passed, and he'd had no choice about that. But he had a choice now. He had a chance. He was taking it, whatever the cost. Fishing his second secret phone out of his pocket, he dialed.
"Hi," he said.
"Hello, hot stuff. What's happening in the side of the city that gives a damn about paint pigmentation formulation?" Tony asked. And just like that, Steve felt the strain go out of his shoulders.
"Don't lie," he said, smiling. "I've seen your secret stash of paint chips."
Tony gave an exaggerated gasp.
"Well, I never," he said,
and the line went dead. Steve stared at his phone, a feeling of bemusement sweeping over him. A second later, the phone rang, and laughing, he answered it.
"That was rash," Tony admitted. "That was a mistake."
"You are the strangest man," Steve said. "You really are."
"You like it,"
Tony said, making kissy noises into the phone. Steve paused.
Yes, he said at last, his voice soft and gentle. I do.
There was a pause. You free tonight? Tony asked. I kind of want to go down to Chinatown. I want dim sum so bad that it's a need.
Steve's eyes closed and he nodded. Realizing that Tony couldn't see it, he said, Yeah, I'd like that. Because it was true.
Lieutenant James Rhodes did not seem like a man easily given to surprise. Still, for a moment, after Tony took a seat on the other side of his table, he just gaped, his mouth hanging open.
I'm sorry, he said, even as Tony was waving at the waitress. And you are?
Tony Edwards. Tony pulled out his license and handed it over. Hello, he said to the waitress as Rhodes stared down at the slim piece of plastic. Bourbon, on the rocks. Big, please. She nodded, one eyebrow arched. I just need to see your... Tony snagged his ID back from Rose's lax fingers and handed it over.
Feel free to take it over to your manager, he said. Everyone does.
Thanks for your understanding, she said without missing a beat. I'll be back with either your drink or the police.
Keep me updated on that, Tony told her, charmed, almost against his will.
He turned back to Rhodes, who was staring at him. You guys encourage a certain level of sassiness around these parts that I hardly approve of, just so you know.
Rhodes didn't say a word, and Tony waved a hand in his general direction.
You still with me, Lieutenant?
Rhodes blinked. I'm sorry, you are... Tony Edwards, Tony repeated, patient for now. But his voice was already a little tight. Can we move on from this particular line of questioning?
Rhodes' eyes narrowed. You expect me to believe you're Mr. Stark's secretary?
Closer to personal assistant, Tony said without missing a beat. Mr. Stark likes them young. Can we please move on?
A hefty glass of alcohol was placed directly in front of him.
I passed, he said.
You passed, the waitress said, tucking a strand of blonde hair behind her ear. Anything else for you, Rhodey?
Rhodes held up his beer mug, still mostly full.
Thanks, Gwen, but I'm all set for now.
Give me a holler if you need anything, she said with a bright smile. And then she was off again, her steps bopping along with a cheerful sort of rhythm.
Tony waited until she was gone before he set his leather satchel on the table.
Why are you asking Mr. Stark about a World War II soldier? He asked without any lead-up. What are you expecting to find?
Rhodes' eyes narrowed, tight dark slits in the dim light of the crowded bar. His face expressionless, he took a sip of his beer. Tony waited him out, waited for him to take a drink, and set the glass back right at the center of the coaster, precise, controlled, considering.
I think he knows the name of the man I'm looking for.
That's it? Tony asked. He picked up his glass and brought it to his lips.
A name? That's all you're after?
That's what I need.
Rhodes leaned forward, one broad hand spreading against the battered wood of the table. That's all I need.
Tony thought about that, keeping his eyes down on the surface of his drink. Rhodes waited him out, didn't press, didn't demand, didn't offer a deal or any false promises.
Why a name? Tony asked at last.
Because a name proves he exists, Rhodes said. A name proves that he was real, that this was a singular man, and allows me to find out where he came from and maybe what happened to him.
He folded his hands on the table. What do you want from this meeting?
Tony nodded. Well, to start, how about you bring the redhead over here before she strains something trying to watch us without looking like she's watching us? Tony asked, folding his arms on the table over the file. Because really, she's really bad at trying to be subtle.
Rhodes didn't flinch, but he did raise his hand and wave at the woman.
A moment later, she was sliding into the booth next to him. She had a pretty face and sharp eyes. Her strawberry blonde hair pulled back in a sleek and simple ponytail. Her skirt and shirt were understated, but well cut for her slim body, and she had sharp, clear eyes.
Virginia Potts, meet Tony Edwards, the man we've come to meet, Rhodey said.
Mr. Edwards, my research partner.
She offered him a hand. Call me Pepper.
Tony shook her hand, not surprised to find her grip firm and warm. Pleased to meet you, Pepper. I'm Tony. He leaned back. You're both Harvard students, then?
Yes, Rhodes said. I'm currently on leave, working on a master's degree in American history, specifically military history. His lips twitched. Being active-duty military gives me access to certain databases and files, and being a Harvard graduate student gives me access to almost all the others.
Except for Stark Industries, of course, Tony said with a tight smile.
And you, Pepper?
I'm going for a double master's from Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School of Government, Pepper said, her voice crisp.
Tony blinked.
And this particular project satisfies which of those? He asked.
Neither, she said. I have an interest in modern folklore.
Okay, Tony said, drawing the word out.
She had compiled a rather legendary set of documentation on first-person accounts of female non-combatants during World War II, Rhodes said.
Pepper rolled her eyes, but her cheeks were pink.
In my undergraduate days, she said, waving it off, out of date by now, but I did have something to offer, and the scope of his project was fascinating.
Tony swirled his liquor in its glass, watching the ice cubes roll along with the movement.
All right, then. Tell me about your research project, Lieutenant.
Rhodes and Pepper shared a glance. She gave a faint nod, and Rhodes looked at Tony.
I'm chasing a battlefield rumor, Rhodes said flatly. One that's popped up over and over in different archives and soldiers' reports all over the world.
Okay, Tony said, taking a sip of his drink.
I'm looking for something that could be termed a ghost squadron, Rhodes said, bracing his folded arms on the table. A small band of soldiers that appeared far, far out of the way from where the American armies and lines should be, mostly on the Eastern Front. But they pop up all through Germany and the Axis countries. They moved fast, they appeared and disappeared in the space of a few days, or even a few hours. They were very good at their jobs, very fast, very efficient, and they did a lot of damage.
Something clicked in Tony's brain.
The Howling Commandos.
Rhodes' eyes went narrow, sharp.
Yes, he said. He leaned forward. They probably would have gone unnoticed, or been forgotten, or written off as a tall tale told to impressionable new arrivals, except for one thing. He reached for his bag, swinging it up onto the table. Their captain was rather distinctive.
He opened the flap of his bag and pulled out a sheath of papers. He glanced around, but it was clear no one in the crowded bar was paying any attention to them. He spread the sheets out on the table between them.
These were produced by half a dozen soldiers from half a dozen countries, he said. Poland, Germany, France, Italy, England, Canada, and Russia, he looked up, meeting Tony's eyes. We pulled them all from different archives or reports, some half a continent away from any other.
Tony's heart was pounding as he picked up the top page. The face wasn't defined, but it was there, the broad cheekbones and long, chiseled jaw, the sharp eyes and winged brows. The hair was sketched in a pale mass, sweeping over the soldier's forehead. His uniform was closer to a costume, blues and whites sketched in, and in one hand was a broad circular shield, ringed in color, and with a precise white star painted in the center, looking for all the world like a target, a dare, a deliberate fuck you to everyone who might be aiming in his general direction.
He's called, popularly, the American Captain, or Captain America. No one had a name for him, but his rank is always the same. His own squad called him merely Cap.
Tony flipped through the images. The face was never distinct, or when it was almost cartoonish, but the uniform, the costume remained virtually unchanged, and the shield was exactly the same. A bullseye, held high on the soldier's arm, or held over his shoulder, or secured to his back. He reached for Howard's file, flipping through the pages, fast, now that pieces were clicking into place in his head. The squad appeared and disappeared repeatedly throughout several years of World War II, and then, without any warning, they simply vanished.
but there's enough proof on record to make me think this isn't a fairy tale invented by men scarred by too many battles, too much death.
Why would it be? Tony asked, his fingers flicking through the papers in front of him.
Classified or not, I'm certain that the U.S. government had forces in places working, doing things that they shouldn't have been doing, that we won't admit now that they were doing.
Why would anyone think this was anything different from any other commando unit?
Because the American captain was quite literally superhuman, Pepper said.
Tony's head came up.
Superhuman? How?
If even half the stories about him and what he did are true, then he was not your average soldier, Rhodes said. He wasn't even your above-average soldier, which brings us to the next secret.
Operation Rebirth, Pepper said. A classified government program run under the auspices of a science unit that never existed to produce a literal super soldier. It was shuttered midway through the war. Officially, it never succeeded, never produced any results of note. However, there are those that believe that it did have a single viable test subject, one man who survived
and went into battle on the side of the United States, hunting an underground and highly dangerous Nazi scientific organization. Rhodes pulled another piece of paper from the file, setting it in the middle of the table. It was a reproduction of a German poster, a piece of propaganda, with a monstrous, tentacled horror spreading around the full span of the globe.
Where one falls, 10 more rise, Tony said, picking his way through the German.
Hail.
Hail Hydra, Rhodes said.
I've never heard of them.
Because someone did a very good job of wiping them out, Pepper explained. But there are places in Europe where entire villages were decimated. They experimented on the local populace, took workers, killed with impunity. Now, of course, it gets rolled in with the rest of the Nazi atrocities. But at the time, there was a distinct difference. There are still people who know the difference.
And let me tell you, if they're given the choice, they'll take the Nazis over Hydra every time, Rhodes said.
He tapped one long finger against the paper. Everywhere there was Hydra on the record, Captain America and the Howling Commandos were almost always right there, destroying laboratories, blowing up factories, invading strongholds. People remember.
Except here, Tony pointed out.
Here they have no reason to remember. The soldiers who saw him in action were either written off as being shell-shocked or were accused of making things up. Most stopped talking about him. But more than a few mentioned him and his squad. Rhodes reached for his glass. We think he was real. That he was the result of a successful experiment in extending human abilities and intelligence. But if that's true, Operation Rebirth was shuttered for reasons we can't explain.
What happened to him?
We don't know. The rumors continued through the end of the war, but at a certain point, they take on the elements of a fairy tale. Crazy things are attributed to them, Rhodes said. Separating fact from fiction becomes increasingly difficult. He took a deep breath. I believe he was either killed or removed from active duty prior to VE Day.
I'm with your crazy-ass conspiracy theory up to this point, Tony said. So why Howard Stark?
We have documentation that proves that he was involved in Operation Rebirth, in the planning stages at the very least. He was attached to the project, but we don't know what the project entailed or how far it went. But we are fairly certain that he has information that we need to move forward.
And that's why we're talking to you, Pepper said, to see if you can arrange it.
We're not even sure that he's... Rhodes started, and Tony cut him off.
I think he did.
He pulled a sheet of paper from his folder and tossed it onto the table between them. It was a simple blueprint schematic, a simple drawing, but it was clear. It was the design for that shield, a perfect, polished arch, and notations of various potential paint jobs.
It would appear, Tony said, as Rhodes reached for the page, his eyes wide, that whatever this is, Mr. Stark was in it up to his eyebrows.
So it would appear. Rhodes frowned down at the numbers.
What is all this?
Material stress, use, metal fatigue, Tony said.
The numbers didn't add up, to be honest. He'd discarded the calculations his first time through. No metal could do what they implied. It was quite simply impossible. Then again, none of this added up. His heart was pounding a little too fast, a little too hard. Super soldier, what the hell did that even mean? He pulled out the picture, the group shot that had been making him crazy for days. He laid it on the table between them. Do you know any of these people? Rhodes looked at Pepper, who was staring down at the sheet, her eyes huge. She licked her lips. Yes, she admitted. Her fingertip, her perfectly formed nail painted a pale seashell pink, hovered over the photo. Howard Stark, of course, and, she glanced up, Colonel Chester Phillips. Rhodes leaned over her shoulder, his eyes narrow. Jesus, you're right. This man, we know his face but not his name. She tapped a finger against the small, pale man standing just next to Howard, a pair of wire-framed glasses perched on his nose. He's appeared in a few photos from this period, but almost always in the background, as if he wasn't aware that the photo was being taken. She frowned down at the picture. And Peggy Carter. Shit. Rhodes looked at her. She looked at him, her eyes wide. It is, but she... Anyone feel like cluing me into what's going on here? Tony asked, not really all that interested. Peggy Carter is... Pepper paused. An unusual figure in U.S. military history. I know of her, but not connected to this. Where is this... Tony flipped the picture over. Operation Rebirth, he read aloud and handed it over. And that's Mr. Stark's writing. Whatever this is, or whenever it was taken, based on the uniforms and the ribbons on Colonel Phillips, well into the war, Rhodes mused, scanning the list of names that were still legible. These are your players, Tony said. He leaned forward. Think we can work together? The files, Pepper said. The ones down in Tazer. They're in the depository if they can be located at all. They got... But we can request them. If Peggy Carter... She was aide-de-camp to Phillips for a few years, but I've never been able to get any proof that he was part of the scientific team, Rhodey said. If we can make an approximation of his movements, where he was assigned, Pepper filled in, where he ended up, see if it matches. The movements of the captain... Pepper was flushed, her grin wide and brilliant. Of course, if he... That's if we can pull up. Tony tuned them out before they started making out at the table. It wasn't as hard as it should have been. He wanted to know what they knew, but none of what they were saying was making sense. He couldn't follow the conversation as long as they were speaking in their own language. He picked up the sheet with the shield schematic and was about to slide it back into the folder when something caught his eye. He turned the page to the side, his head tilting as he found a small, penciled notation. It was faint, almost invisible now, but still legible. Howard, paint unimportant, do what you like. And after that, a single, sharp, capital S for a signature. As if in a trance, Tony pulled his notebook from his pocket, flipping through the pages, until he located the one where Steve had written down his number. He held the notebook next to the note and stared at the two identical letters, side by side and separated by decades. He was insane. He was completely mad. What was he thinking, that Steve was a man who'd been an adult in World War II? There was no way. It was impossible. He was only a few years older than Tony, and Tony needed to stop even considering things that were utterly fucking crazy. It doesn't make sense, he said aloud, his voice distant to his own ears. Yes, but we have a starting point, Rhodes said, and Tony jerked back into himself, his notebook slipping from nerveless fingers to crash to the table. He fumbled for it. Where? Tazer, Potts said. Her eyes dancing. Tazer Library. There's some files there that we've been trying to access and having no luck, but this could be what we were looking for. Okay, Tony said, jamming his notebook back in his pocket. His fingers clung to it, using the grip to keep his hand from shaking. When are we going?
They exchanged a glance. They don't let non-Harvard personnel in, Pepper explained. You'll have to apply for a visiting academic permit if you're trying to access their files. We might be able to get you in if we vouch for you, but that won't work more than once, Rhodes explained. Hopefully we won't need more than once, Tony finished, his drink in a gulp, feeling it burn the entire way down his throat. He fished copies of the picture out of the folder front and back and handed them over before he slid the file back into his bag. I'm interested in whatever you can tell me about this man, he said, pointing to the miniature Steve on the edge of the group. Call me when you're ready to set up another meeting, preferably at this library of yours. Rhodes took the pages, sliding them into his satchel. Will Mr. Stark be joining us? Not just yet, Tony said. I need to find out a few more things before I involve him. Does he know you're here? Rhodes asked as Tony slid out of the booth. No, Tony said after a beat of pause. Keep the lies simple, easy to remember, hard to fuck up. If and when I choose to bring this to his attention, I'll let you know. However, for the time being, I'm going to give you access to his archives, what I can find on this particular project. Why? Pepper asked. Because whatever you're looking for, Tony said baldly, someone else is looking for, too. And if this is going to blow up in the face of Stark Industries, it's best we're prepared for it. He tucked his bag up on his shoulder. Something's happening. I'd like to know what, who the players are, and what they're looking for. He gave them a bland smile. Let me know, and I'll make time to meet with you. With that, he headed for that door, his shoulders back, his strides quick. He passed the waitress on the way out of the door, passing her 220s to pay their bill. And then he was out into the cold of Harvard Square. Shit, he muttered to himself. In his pocket, he clutched his notebook. What the fuck is going on here? No one answered. His lips kicked up. What do you know? He said, heading for the red line. Turns out Harvard doesn't have all the answers after all. Tell me you're not tempted. I'm not tempted, Steve grinned. You're lying. Tony was barely awake, huddled over a cup of coffee and against Steve's side. The heating in the Green Line trolley was, as always, inadequate. I am not lying. I am not getting on a Blue Line train for anything short of a winning lottery ticket. Steve shifted so that Tony could duck under the shelter of his arm. But Wonderland? No, we are not taking the Blue Line just so you can say you've taken the train to Wonderland. Seems like a good reason as any to get on the T, Steve mused. And he felt rather than heard Tony's sigh. He bit back a grin. Teasing Tony was far more fun than it should be. Steve. Steven. Tony took a long sip of his coffee. Steve waited patiently until he lowered the cup. No. Steve chuckled. Wonderland. It's Revere, Steve. Wonderland is Revere. One of my favorite patriots. Tony was visibly shaking with the effort not to laugh now. It's the damn greyhound track. It's dog racing. We are not going to the dog track. It's... He stopped, shook his head. I am not watching a bunch of neurotic dogs chase a plywood cutout of a rabbit in circles. Is that the only reason people go to Wonderland? Steve asked. He flipped the map over in his hands, his eyes tracing the various lines with open curiosity. Something else has to be out there, right? During the summer, I guess swimming, Tony said. Revere Beach is the oldest public beach in the country. He sipped his coffee. Established in 1896. Steve grinned at him. Really? I thought Coney Island was... He stopped, and Tony glanced up at him. I think, he said, pushing his hand through his hair, that Coney's older as a resort, but Revere's public. State made it a reservation, something like that. We could go there, Steve said. First of all, no, it's the Blue Line. Jesus, absolutely not. There is no reason to set foot on the Blue Line. I don't understand your odd prejudice about the various lines, Steve said, arching an eyebrow. The trains are mostly the same. They are not the same. You bite your tongue, you blaspheming. Is this an engineering thing? This is a class thing, Tony said, and he sounded so indignant that Steve couldn't help but laugh. I'm not listening to you. You love the Green Line. Green Line is honest about what it is, mechanical and cranky, and I like hearing the wheels and feeling the trains rock on the tracks. And you can stick it. You like the Red Line. I like whatever train gets me where I'm going to go, Steve said, and Tony waved him off. I'm not even dignifying that with a response. That'd be a first. Tony blinked at him. Was that sass? Did I just get sassed? Ah, so proud of you, growing up, becoming bitter. It's a miracle. He set his empty cup beside him. And secondly, I'm not really eager to go swimming at this time of year, Tony said, his eyes sliding to half-mast. I'd prefer to follow our original plan, which is to go to brunch and eat like a metric ton of food that is not good for us. He gave a faint chuckle. I mean, can you imagine how cold the water is in the North Atlantic right now? The water crashed over his head so fast that he didn't even see the wave coming. The words were so innocuous, so offhand, that it hit him broadside and sent him spiraling, and then the riptide had him. His breath was coming in fast, thin pants, his heart pounding hard in his chest. He couldn't see, couldn't think. He was barely aware of his arms, his hands, his whole body shaking as he struggled to reorient himself. He sucked in a breath and another, and it tasted like ice in his throat. He couldn't seem to get clear, couldn't seem to fill his lungs, because the water was there. He had to breathe fast while his head was still above water. The waves would come soon enough. His mouth tasted like seawater and copper, and he wanted to scream and had no breath left. He was drowning. He was drowning in dry air, and he could not breathe. He could not breathe because there was water pressing in on the seam of his lips and his nostrils and his eyelids. The salt was burning on his skin, the salt and the cold, and he could feel the numbness sweeping over him, and he wanted to live. There was no doubt about that. He wanted so desperately to live, because she was still calling his name. Steve! He jerked back into himself so suddenly that he was completely lost for a second, and when the red cleared from his eyes, when he could blink himself back into something resembling sense, he found the trolley quiet, faces staring in his direction, confused and worried and scared. Tony's hands were gripping his wrists, his face white, his eyes huge and dark, and his fingers were biting into Steve's skin with enough force to bruise. Sorry, Steve choked out, and his voice sounded raw. I'm sorry, I don't. Okay. Okay. Tony sounded panicked, but he was handling it well. He reached up and tagged the stop strip. Come on, let's get some air. Steve scraped a hand over his face, and his skin was clammy and cold, and he was still struggling to get his breathing under control. I'm okay. Yeah, but I'm out of coffee. Let's get off now, Tony said, and his voice was tense, tight, and humiliation swept over Steve. The trolley screeched to a stop, and Tony tugged on Steve's arm. Come on, he said, his voice a lifeline that Steve couldn't help but cling to. There's a Dunkies over there. He wasn't sure how he managed to get to his feet, to move himself out the door, but he managed it, because he had to, because Tony had a death grip on his arm. As the trolley rumbled away, Tony ducked under Steve's arm, pulling it across his shoulders. We okay? He asked, and it wasn't really a question. Steve's feet felt leaden as they scraped across the cold stone of the street. Yes, he said, through frozen lips. I'm fine. Well, not to call you a liar, Steve, but I think you're not being completely honest with me right now. Tony got them through the door to the donut shop, and the hot air, fragrant with sugar and coffee, was almost painful on Steve's oversensitive skin. Tony lowered Steve into an empty booth. Stay here. Steve wondered if he could make it to the door, or if he'd humiliate himself further by falling on his face halfway there. He dropped his head into his hands
and tried to steady his breathing. Hey. His head snapped up and Tony was back, and he had no idea how much time had passed. Tony reached out, setting a small cup of coffee on the table right in front of Steve. Here, he said, sliding into the other side of the booth. I want you to drink that. Steve studied the cup and the steam curling from the narrow slit in the lid and wondered idly if it would stay down. I'm fine. Yeah, okay, Tony said, nodding his hands in front of him. I need to know what I said, 'cause I got nothing. Steve reached for the cup and his hand shook. It wasn't you. Steve, Tony leaned forward. Hey, I know a panic attack when I see one. And if I accidentally stumbled across something that made that happen, you gotta tell me. You gotta give me a hint. Because I can't be responsible for doing that again. That was... His face crumbled, and he looked so young it hurt. That was horrible. Steve flinched. Sorry. No, I mean, knowing I did... Tony waved a hand. That I did that to you. It sucked. He swallowed, his mouth tight. So just give me a hint. What do I avoid? His eyes came up fast and darted back down just as quickly, and they were unreadable. I don't want to hurt you. His eyes closed because it was easier to do this if he didn't have to look at Tony. Water, he said at last. And that was weak. That was cowardly. How could he possibly expect to handle this at all if he couldn't even make the words form? I drowned, I guess. That's the only way to put it. And it wasn't. His throat closed up and he had to force the words out. I went down in the ocean and obviously I... You got better, Tony said, a faint smile on his face. I survived, Steve said. Because that was what this was. This was surviving. This was the painful, unending slog of trying to move forward, trying to ignore at the way his feet were sinking into the mud with each slow step. He looked up, met Tony's eyes again. The North Atlantic comment. He buried his face behind the coffee cup, glad to have the ability to hide even for a moment. Okay. Tony's eyes were steady. You can't swim? Steve took a deep breath. No, I can't. I mean, yes, I can. I can swim. I like swimming, actually. I was a sickly kid, actually, and in the water was one of the few places I could keep up with everyone else. He paused. I know how to swim. Bucky made sure of that. Tony's eyebrows arched. Bucky? Who's Bucky? My best friend growing up, Steve said, ignoring the ache in his chest. Bucky Barnes. He folded his hands around the coffee cup. He's gone now, too, but when we were growing up, we were always together, and he sometimes, well, he cleared his throat. Sometimes we got out to Coney Island, even if we couldn't afford the trip. Steve, Tony clutched his chest. Did you hop the train? You lawbreaker? In a manner of speaking, Steve's head hung down, and he realized he was smiling just a little. Bucky was always braver than me, and sometimes a bit less strict about morality. Okay, seriously, his parents named him Bucky? Tony asked, his voice incredulous. Steve laughed, and it was weak and thin, but it was a real laugh, unforced and uncoerced. His parents named him James, he said, and no one called him that, even his parents. How does one end up with a nickname like Bucky? You know, I asked him that once. Tony glanced at him, his dark eyes gleaming. Well, what did he say? He said if I asked again, he'd pop me one in the nose. Steve grinned at him and Tony laughed. Sounds like a sibling. He was the closest thing I had to one, Steve admitted. His smile died. I miss him. More than anyone else I've lost, I miss him. It was an ache he didn't like to acknowledge, that he couldn't look at too closely. Peggy and Howard,
Dugan and all of them, he missed a lot of people. But the thought of Bucky was like an exposed nerve. The tiniest contact and the agony shot through to his bones. Maybe it was because of how he'd died, because Steve could still remember the look in his eyes as he fell out of sight. Tony jostled his elbow, and Steve jerked back into the present. "Sorry," he managed. His skin felt clammy, too tight, too cold, and Tony stared at him, his brows drawn up tight. Tony glanced away and stood up. "Here's what we're going to do," he said, jamming his hands in his pockets. His coat was worn at the elbows, scuffed and just beginning to fray, stretched tight over his arms. "We are going to get our asses back onto the Green Line, and we're going to Heinz, and we're going to walk the block down to Newbury Street to Trident. I'm going to eat my weight in ricotta-stuffed French toast with an obscene amount of blueberries on top. I'm serious. If the blueberries don't outweigh the French toast by an order of magnitude, I'm sending that shit back." Steve felt the grin stretching his cheeks. "Really, Tony?" "I am utterly sincere right now," Tony told him. "Anyway, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted, I'm going to gorge on French toast, and you're going to try like 17 different teas, because that's what you do at places like this. And we'll poke around Newbury Street. Maybe I'll buy you a suit or something." "No, you won't," Steve told him. "Fine. See if I try to be benevolent again. But when we're done, we can get back on the Green Line and ride it out." He leaned over the table, fumbling at Steve's jacket pocket. "Got your map. All right. You New York interloper, how do we get from the Green Line to the Blue Line?" Steve's lips twitched. "Green Line to Lechmere. Transfer to the Blue Line at Government Center." "Correct." Tony folded the map and jammed it into his pocket. "And after we eat, we can go all the way out to Wonderland, and you can check that off your bucket list." Steve took a deep breath. "Take the train to Wonderland?" he asked. "We can. And maybe just see the ocean if you want to." Tony held out a hand, palm up, an open offer, and Steve took it, glad for something to hold on to. "I used to love the ocean," he said, his voice soft. It was achingly sad, even to his own ears. Tony's fingers squeezed tight around Steve's hand. "We don't have to go. It's your choice." Steve's eyes closed. "I think." He handed Tony his half-full coffee cup. "I think I want to." He glanced toward the window, and the cold didn't seem so terrifying anymore. There were nightmares hiding in every shadow. He knew that. But for now, all he could see was the sunshine. "If you're coming with me, I think that I do." Tony grinned. "I think we can manage that." James Barnes. "Excuse me?" "It's a name," Tony said, trying for patience, and judging by the icy silence on the other end of the line, failing miserably. He took a deep breath, trying not to let his internal turmoil show. "James Barnes, nicknamed Bucky, from Brooklyn, New York." "You're giving me this. Why?" "Because I think he's got a connection to your mystery man." That got Rhodes' attention. "And you think this why?" "Found something in the archive that mentions him." Tony resisted the urge to punch something. "Any reason you aren't just taking the tip?" "Because I am aware of a Sergeant James Barnes of Brooklyn, New York," Rhodes said. 501st Infantry, World War II, served with distinction, died in the line of duty." Tony paused. Stunned, he sat down hard. "You know this? How?" "Early on in this project, before it became an official project, I pulled files from the military database, using some basic criteria. Race, age, general enlistment dates, field of combat. A black man sent to the Pacific Theater, obviously, was not who I was looking for. I was able to narrow it down somewhat, and then just started going through files, looking for ones that felt wrong. Barnes was one of a couple hundred listed soldiers who served with distinction, but has some or all of their file listed as classified. He was a sniper, very high skill level, captured by the Nazis during a major troop movement, and eventually liberated
after some time in what amounted to a prison camp. Rumors circulate that the camp, or rather the factory, was a Hydra facility, but details are, shall we say, sketchy. Tony paused, eyes closed, trying not to see Steve's face, to think about impossible things, terrifying things. You think he's your man? No. Or if he is, there were multiples. He has a listed date of death, killed in action. No further information available about the circumstances. His death predates a major action on the part of the commando unit. And according to what we have, the captain was still in play at that point. So either someone else picked up the shield, his date of death was falsified, or he isn't our man. I'm inclined to think it's the latter choice. Why? Because almost all the descriptions or drawings show the captain as being a blonde. Barnes was not. Very dark brown hair. What, they didn't have bleach during World War II? Tony asked, settling in front of his computer. His heel twitched against the leg of his stool, beating a rapid tattoo. Why would they bother? Rhodes shot back, practical about it. If they were going for anonymous, then leaving him as a brunette would have been a much better choice. Far more of them than there are men with pale blonde hair. Tony glanced at the picture of Steve that was pinned to his bulletin board beside his desk. He was staring at a stormy winter sea, his eyes sad, but with a faint smile, his pale hair waving in the wind. Yeah, Tony said aloud. There's that. He leaned back, his chest aching. Okay. Send me what you have on Barnes, will you? I'll see if I can find anything else in the SI databases. Fine, Rhodes said, sounding amused. Can I do anything else for you today, Mr. Edwards? No, thank you, Lieutenant, Tony said without an ounce of shame. I think I can take it from here. Good. Glad to hear it. There was a sound of papers rustling on the other end of the line. Pepper, through some combination of favors and threats, has managed to get you a day pass for Tazer. Which is what, exactly? Tony asked. He hit the refresh button on his email program and considered asking Rhodes if he had sent the file yet. It seemed like a bad idea, which meant it was right up his alley. Tazer Library? Rhodes asked. He seemed to take Tony's lack of response as confusion, as opposed to lack of interest, which was closer to the truth. He sighed. Tazer is one of Harvard's libraries, and it's got a file we're looking for, but it was in depository, so we requested it, so... I'd say this is Greek to me, but I speak enough Greek to make this even less comprehensible, Tony said. Can I just have a location and a time, and I'll work with that? There was a beat of pause. Are you actually paying attention to anything I'm saying right now? Not really, but you know, I'll try. I've got a pretty good memory, unless I'm distracted by something. I'll email you. Yeah, that's probably for the best, Tony said. Did you send me that file? Are you refreshing your inbox? Tony stopped. No. Were you? Maybe. What's the difference? Tony said, sounding petulant, even to his own ears. No difference on my end. I just wanted to know if you'd admit it. Tony's lips twitched. Fine. I was hitting the F5 so fast that a woodpecker showed up in the window, okay? He grinned as the email notification popped up. Thank you. You're very welcome, Mr. Edwards. Rhodes sounded amused. I'll see you in 2 days. Yeah, Tony said, already focused on the file. He vaguely heard Rhodes say goodbye, and took that as a cue to toss his phone to the side. James Bucky Barnes was an ordinary-looking man. Handsome, certainly, with a file photo that looked serious, his sweetly curved lips set in a straight line, his dark brows lowered tight over dark eyes. He stared at the camera, proud and serious in equal parts. Tony flipped through the electronic pages, reading what information that remained. Most of it was blacked out, truncated, and clipped. Basic information remained. Date of birth, his enlistment date, his next of kin, a series of medals and awards, from the beginning of his service to those awarded after the listed date of death. Nothing much at all. Tony was about to close it when he noticed a small notation made in pencil on the originals, barely visible in this copy. He picked up his phone. "What does this mean?" he asked when Rhodes picked up. "What does what mean?" Rhodes replied, not put off. Tony read off the sequence of notations and Rhodes made a low humming noise. "Oh, that's a shorthand for a file connection. It means that Barnes was listed in another file." "Why?" "Hard to say without pulling the file. I'll take a look. The numbers aren't familiar to me, so I don't think it was one that I've looked into. I'll see what I can find." Tony stared down at Barnes's face across the span of time. "Thanks," he said. "Yeah, I'll see you in a couple of days." He paused. "Right?" "Tozer, right," Tony said. "Got it. Really, I'll be there." "I appreciate that."